Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and we are honored to host the Chief of the Royal Australian Air Force, Air Marshal Mel Hupfield, for a conversation regarding Allied Air Power. He's a career aviator, fighter pilot, and now serves as the top officer in the Royal Australian Air Force. And this is a conversation that is really timely. As everyone knows, activity in the Indo-Pacific are especially important these days. Achieving success is not something we can do by ourselves. It's going to take a team effort, and the Royal Australian Air Force stands at the center of that. Well, joining me for this conversation is Major General Larry Stutzream. Sir, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Luke. It's great to be back.
Sir, you have career experience in the Indo-Pacific. Any thoughts you want to share when it comes to the Royal Australian Air Force?
Yes, Early in my career, I interfaced with the airmen there as a young officer, young fighter pilot in the Pacific. And I've since then in my career engaged in a number of exercises and also worked issues at a strategy level in the Air Staff. And I continue to be involved with the Aussie Aviators through my role at Mitchell. And there's a key point I want to get across, Slick. This is an Air Force that punches well above their weight. Whether you're looking at the Air Force from a strategic, operational, or tactical perspective, these guys never disappoint. And I tell you, I'd be happy to fly into combat with them anytime, anywhere. And that's exactly what we've done as a nation since the dawn of air combat. We've been together from World War I through World War II to today, and we've continually partnered with the Royal Australian Air Force Aviators, so it's a very special honor to have Air Marshal Hupfield with us today.
Well, Stutz, speaking from personal experience, I second your thoughts. As you know, I've spent a lot of time out at Nellis and at the Weapons School, and one thing was for sure, when the Royal Australian Air Force showed up for an exercise like Red Flag, you had to get ready for a varsity experience. And now that they have a fifth-generation Air Force with the F-35, the partnership is really going to accelerate.
Well, with that, Slick, let's welcome our guest, Air Marshal Mel Hupfield. Thanks so much for joining us today, Chief.
Yes, sir. Thanks for being here. It's an honor.
Yeah, thanks, Stutz. It's truly great to be with you all. The discussions and examination of air power in the Indo-Pacific is a pretty key and important topic for the Royal Australian Air Force, and in fact for all of us now with the changing environment. And very much notably for us this year, it's our Air Force's 100th centenary, so quite a poignant moment for us
yes.
this year.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you. And of course, very much linked to that, as of the 1st of September, the 70th anniversary of ANZUS. So the depth of the relationship with between Australia and the US is very, very clear to us right at this moment.
And we all hold that. So many of us have been associated with your Air Force and have visited and have exercised and flown with. Sir, the relationship, of course, as we're saying right now, is so important, and it's about safeguarding freedoms and prosperity both our nations share and enjoy. And but there are many difficult challenges to that shared purpose, so I'd like to kick off our discussion with some context. Could you describe Australia's take on the global security environment these days? And then how about the specifics of the Indo-Pacific theater? I'd have to believe there's some special concerns out there that hit close to home for the Royal Australian Air Force.
Yeah, it's, well, there's no doubt that the geostrategic environment is changing, and it's changing quite rapidly. That's very apparent to our government. This time of accelerated competition and the very well-used term of the grey zone, very clear to us in the Indo-Pacific, to a lesser extent, but still impacted not just through China's elements of competition in there, but also Russia in some ways as well. So we get to see that, the great power competition as it's starting to develop. Our government's made it fairly clear that their view is that while major conflict may be still unlikely, it's certainly far less remote than it used to be. And as we see it, our government's had to contend with that, and in the last few years has actually been standing up to that as the concepts of the rules-based global order are being challenged. and Australia's place in the world, and particularly in our neighbourhood, where we seek to very much ensure that we can build the security environment, and with that levels of prosperity, and certainly enable political sovereignty. Very important to our government. And then as a military force, we're having a very strong look at what our role will be and how we'll need to operate in that type of an environment. And of course, I think our Air Force is pretty strong. It's certainly among one of the best in the world, but the capabilities are there. We have some challenges with capacity. And when we're talking about a region and an area that's so vast, it's so vitally important that we can work together with all nations in the region, with our key allies, partners, and indeed friends, to make sure that we're able to operate successfully to continue to promote, support that rules-based global order and further progress those national interests, and particularly where they intersect across like-minded nations.
Oh, very good. We'll talk a little more about a few of those chords you just brought up, but as I understand it, the Australian government released a new defense strategy, or it was updated in 2020, and there were three strategic objectives in that strategy. Can you describe, first of all, the significance of the update, and walk us through those three objectives?
Yeah, I think the update really does show it's the first statement of change in terms of the Australian government recognising this period of competition, the need to be able to respond appropriately. And they've put out the strategic update in 2020 that covered off on three key strategic objectives. And those three objectives, the first one is to shape our environment. The second one is to deter actions that are against our interests as a nation. And thirdly is to respond with credible military force if and when required. And I think some of the key aspects of that is that we can't approach that in the traditional campaign sense that we might have done in terms of military action or military activity. A shape, deter, respond isn't really a linear approach, particularly in this time of competition. And when we're operating in the grey zone, it requires us to be able to do all of those things often simultaneously. And respond isn't going to be in the sense that we've traditionally prepared for as a military force. We look at the most likely, most dangerous scenarios, and if you like, we tend to focus on the most dangerous, and that's being very skilled, competent, and able to respond in a high-end warfighting sense. But for us now, as a military capability, and as air power assisting, or as a part of our joint force to support our national objectives, we need to be able to operate in that grey zone and bring air power. Our value proposition to our government is changing. We need to look at things differently. And how do we contribute air power in that era of competition, which is the most likely circumstance for us at the moment, but still being ready, able, with the preparedness and readiness to contribute to high-end warfighting if and when it was needed. And that shape, deter, respond across the grey zone, but being ready if we are to be successful in shape, deter, respond, then certainly our objective would be to avoid that high-end conflict. And yes. It's a really, really challenging environment and time for us to rethink our strategic outcomes and how we approach these challenges.
Sir, how does the public in Australia perceive the threat environment? I mean, obviously you've got a threat in your backyard compared to us here in the United States. So given the competition and the pressures from COVID and the increased economic factors with China, as well, more and more examples of their aggressive behavior in the region, I think it's a complex issue.
Yeah. I'd probably just change your words there slightly. Australia's not a superpower. We're a modest size nation. We have a large island to protect, but we don't look at the world through that threat lens in the same way that perhaps the US might. Certainly we have some very strong competitors that are contesting our national interests and what we regard as the standing international rules. Certainly there are threats from things like pandemics, international terrorism, climate change. They're things that we would refer to certainly in a threat context. But what has changed for our government is that they do recognise that the competitive environment that we're in, we can no longer tolerate. And we've seen that with the government standing up to some aspects of coercion and indeed competition. And in the example, if we consider China, we've had lobsters that have been affected by trade and responses to 5G network decisions that our government's taken. The Chinese Communist Party has tried to inflict some response on that to stop Australia responding in that way, providing trade restrictions with lobsters rotting on the wharves, with restrictions on wine exports, with restrictions on iron ore. And these are all things that the initial outcry from our public was kind of strong. You know, there were markets that are affected, people's livelihoods were being affected. But more recently now, I think people can see that this is the right thing to do. So the Australian public, the sense I have is that they are starting to realise that we can't just accept that a nation that has benefited from the rules-based global order is now operating outside those boundaries. And that creates quite a dilemma for the Australian government and indeed for the people. And our people are responding, diversifying their markets, finding alternate ways, thinking more innovatively to find ways to ensure that we can continue our free and open trade opportunities, build the prosperity for Australia. And in so doing, COVID in some ways has given us very clear examples of the contested and competitive environment through other means. It's the threat of a pandemic, and the action of a pandemic has required us to think differently. And we need to recover from this. The economic blows to all of our nations is very, very apparent to us. We need to find ways to overcome that. And I think the public are really starting to work behind that. And of course, that is very consistent with our government's strategic update and the policy settings that they provided and the directions they've given to the Australian Defence Force and how we should respond in this way. So we'll continue to do that. And most importantly, we'll continue to work very strongly with key partners in nations in the Southwest Pacific, nations in Southeast Asia, and working with key partners that have capacity and opportunity to support our neighbourhood. And, of course, the U.S. Is a key part of our engagement.
I really appreciate that context and those insights. But we need to move a little bit to those things that are near and dear to us, our aircraft, and for both of our air forces to meet the demands that all this you've described are placed squarely on the air and space capabilities our two air forces have. We're looking at some challenges in basic aircraft inventory. So could you start by giving us a rundown on your current fleet? Where do things stand?
Yeah, sure. I think my tenure as the Chief of Air Force, I've been extremely fortunate. Those Chiefs of Air Force that came before me, they did an amazing job of building our Air Force up to be one of the most modern in the world. It wasn't too long ago that the oldest aircraft we had on the tarmac was a C-130J. So we've got, F-35 is at the forefront of our air combat capability. Right. It's not the only piece. It's a part of our air combat mix. It's a vital part. But with our Super Hornets, with Growlers, with our E-7 Wedgetail as the command and control aircraft that helps us keep our battle space awareness, with tanker aircraft giving us strategic air mobility as well as that force projection opportunity, we have become an air force that can force project. And if I go back to 2003, I commanded one of our squadrons when we contributed to Iraqi freedom. We sent 14 aeroplanes across to the Middle East. We used US C-17s and US tankers to get us there. If you fast forward to 2014, which is quite a long time ago now, when ISIL first kicked off, we deployed ourselves, our own C-17s, our own tankers, and that level of capability just continues to grow and build in our Air Force today, and we've got plans to still develop further capabilities. But the significant difference in our Air Force as we move forward, and as I've mentioned earlier, this is our 100th year. So we're looking forward. What's next for our second century of air power? In fact, air and space power. The key part for us, it's always been the case, but it becomes even more evident now, and that's our people. It's our people that operate those systems that are so essential. We have opportunity and need to change the skills to make sure we've got the right skills in the right place at the right time, to build our force, to give them a far clearer opportunity to understand the strategic circumstances that we find ourselves in. They're the ones that operate for us. They need to know what we're doing and why we're doing things and how we do that to support our government objectives. So that's a key part of, you know, our fleet, if you like, in terms of operating the system. There's other parts to it as well, and I talked about Australia. It's the world's biggest island. It's expeditionary. Everything we do is expeditionary. So for that, our air base has become a key capability. And we fight from, as I talk to our army, I explain to them, we fight from our garrison. It's important that we can recognise those air bases as weapon systems in their own right. We need to develop those. We've, in some ways, been a little bit shy on taking care of those aspects, the facilities, the infrastructure, ICT networks, and building and ensuring that they're robust and resilient. And once we get our permanent bases set up like that and bring those forward, then we want to start to look at the more austere bases that we have both in Australia and within our region, so that we can operate from those. And that starts to bring us to conversations about agile combat employment as well. So there's many aspects to our Air Force now, and it's not just about the aircraft. There's a lot more to delivering air power than just the aircraft that we operate.
Very well said.
Well, sir, that's a great segue into my next question, and specifically talking about the E-7 Wedgetail, but not really the aircraft itself, but more focused on this next generation of aerial command and control. Can you speak to us about the capabilities of the platform, how important the C-2 is, and what it affords, and how you can integrate with older U.S. legacy systems like the E-3 AWACS and joint exercises?
Yeah, and the partnership with the U.S. in this regard has been very strong. The E-7, E-3 community relationships have always been strong. I think we've been very fortunate. We took some risk in the early days of the development of an E-7. That was our first foray into an airborne early warning control type capability. So we needed to help and learn, or get help and to learn from the US and the UK, key partners in what we do. And we developed the E-7, I think, into probably the world's leading airborne early warning and control aircraft that has some immense capabilities, an electronically scanned array, the search capabilities, the performance, the detections that it can make, with the technical aspects of its configuration and the architecture, make it a very, very high-performing asset. We're certainly very proud of it. It took us a lot of time to work through it. The secret was in the partnership with industry, putting operators and industry together to be able to work and respond very quickly and spirally develop the capability to the point where it's at the moment. But we're continuing that relationship, particularly with the US. We've got E3 battle managers that are operating on our system. We'd be very keen for other countries to operate the E-7, particularly those that are very like-minded with us, and we think it's a good capability. And in the current time frame, its ability to fit within what I referred to earlier as our air combat mix. The F-35 is a great aeroplane. Super Hornets and Growlers are great aeroplanes. But when you put them together with a system like the E-7, where it's networked, it's connected, we link that into an air warfare destroyer that's sitting on the surface. That starts to become quite a capable force mix that you can employ and put it where you need it. And while I said, the Australian Defence Force, a small force, I think it's pretty powerful. What we lack in capacity, we certainly make up for in capability. But what that means to us is we have to be able to work with our key partners That well-used phrase, we're stronger together, you know, that works during COVID, and it applies equally in that strategic environment where we need to both, all three, shape, deter, and if necessary, respond. We can't do this alone, but I think we've got some great capabilities that will contribute to what's needed across that full spectrum.
Well, Chief, you've walked us into a discussion of joint all-domain command and control, and it's obviously a concept that's evolving. And how do you see this, and where is the Royal Australian Air Force involved in it, and how are you exploring it?
Yeah, wow, what an amazing challenge. In some ways, it scares me to think what we might need to be able to do. We're going to have to take some opportunities and some risks here to develop what we would call joint all-domain command and control. And our journey, certainly we've been engaging strongly with the US to see what concepts might be coming forward and how we might approach this. It's absolutely essential for our environment in that Indo-Pacific. You know, we've talked about the huge area we've got to cover. Having robust, coherent command and control is essential to that, to know where you want to put different capabilities. And that is literally has to be across all domains. And we're expanding in the space domain now as well to understand how we might use that as an operational domain. But we've got to be able to be interoperable with our key partners in this regard as well. So we have strong aspirations and strong ambition to develop what we, our version of what you'd call the joint all-domain command and control system. We have a integrated air and missile defence program that we're now starting to develop. I'm what you call the multi-domain program lead for that program. A key part of that will be our advanced battle management system that will be a part of it. We're calling it the Joint Air Battle Management System. And we're working with, at the moment, two key partners to down-select. One as a strategic partner in that endeavour, and that's Lockheed Martin Australia and Northrop Grumman Australia. Australian partners of the American primes. We need to use and engage there to get the architectures, the interoperability, the certification that we will need for our system to ensure that it's interoperable and can tie in very seamlessly with any of the US systems. But I think where we will have an advantage to accelerate forward, and I take note of General C.Q. Brown's language of accelerate, change or lose. It's the same for us. We need to be able to accelerate forward on our acquisition program. It needs to be integrated for us. In terms of a small force, we, I think, have demonstrated and have an opportunity to excel in joint warfighting. To do that with a integrated air and missile defence program relies on our ability to join and mix all sensors and all effectors that we have at our disposal within the Australian Defence Force, working with our Army, our Navy, working with our defence civilians, the organisations, the intelligence networks, having the ability to join and network all those capabilities up to the top secret level becomes essential for what we need to do here. We'll start small and we'll build. Our integrated air and missile program is focused on defence of our deployable systems. But as we find and prioritise funding, as we understand the strategic environment and what technology will do for us and also what it will prevent as challenges in terms of some of the systems that we might need to operate against, that will bring us all together to try and find a solution to this challenge that we're calling joint all-domain command and control. It becomes a really key aspect of that US prime link so that we can stay interoperable with the US and build a system that I think we can try a number of different opportunities. We'll probably try and take a slightly different approach to the US, be a bit more expansive and start with concepts and find the technology to build it rather than sit and wait for the technology to come before we build a system. If we want to be agile and rapid in our acquisition, then we need to take every opportunity we can, accept a bit of risk. And if it fails, well, we'll head in another direction. And we've got some opportunities to do that, not just with those two companies that I mentioned, but all of the primes that are represented in Australia. They each have a part to play, and we need to be able to collaborate with industry. While we do that initial competition to select a strategic partner, we need to be able to collaborate to get the best of breed, because not one industry partner can provide the total solution. They need to work together to give us something that's going to meet our need.
Well, sir, you mentioned the F-35 a couple times in your comments, and I'm just curious, what does it mean for your Air Force to gain fifth-generation fighter aircraft technology, and how is this playing out at the operational level?
I mean, it's an immense opportunity here, and it's a demonstration of that trusted relationship that we have with other key partners. Of course, the U.S. leading the F-35 program, but the Joint Program Office and the joint partners. This is truly about like-minded nations being able to deliver capability. The F-35 for us, it's certainly, as I've said, a part of that air combat mix, but it gives us that freedom of manoeuvre. It gives us access into areas that we'd be otherwise having to hold at risk. It gives us the opportunity to compete and show the capability that we can actually deliver. And of course, I think the F-35 does clearly demonstrate a blurring of the lines between the tactical, operational and the strategic levels and the capabilities it provides. And that's where we are needing to build that level of strategic acumen and awareness at all levels of our organisation. Certainly the air crew that operate, as aviators in our Air Force, they're at the front of delivering the capability, but our technicians that maintain and support the delivery of the aircraft, they need to understand exactly what that thing can do and where it fits within that air combat mix so that we can get the most out of it. And if I draw back to the words of a US Marine Corps pilot that came to Australia quite a number of years ago at one of our conferences that we ran there, and his advice to us was the F-35, bring it on. He says it replaces nothing but changes everything. And I think that's what's happened in terms of our thinking, the culture behind what we're doing, the mindset that we have in how we employ our capabilities. It's spread across the whole of our system. And if I talk about air combat, I do include our air mobility assets and the combat supporting assets that we have on the ground. It's bringing their mindset further forward about how we connect, how we operate, how we conduct our business at a high security level with very highly protected systems that we need to operate effectively up to a combat scenario. But also, how do we do that in this grey zone? So it's truly an exciting time. It's been a challenging time, but now our Air Forces are responding, and we're delivering those capabilities. And we can, in some ways, be more agile. We're a bit smaller. We can try things. Our tactics, techniques, and procedures can accelerate more quickly. And sharing and operating and contributing to the whole of the international system, particularly with our key partners in the US, is a key one of those.
Well, sir, I was going to ask, looking at the allied community, how are you seeing synergies that this fifth-gen aircraft and capability are empowering?
Well, it's forcing us to communicate, to talk. The enormous force multiplier effect that this aircraft provides across all of the nations, it really brings and is a forcing function for interoperability. We have just recently... I've been involved in the Pacific Air Chiefs Conference, of which a number of the nations there either are operating F-35 or they're intending to. And, of course, in NATO and Europe, there's a number of nations there that we also engage with. So this brings, you call it the allied community. Australia only has two allies that are formally put into an alliance through a treaty, and that's the US and New Zealand. But our partners... we have strong partnerships and strong interoperability with those countries that are like-minded. And a system such as F-35 and the broader system that we operate really brings us all closer together.
Chief, I just want to say that your comment about changes everything. We find that we are continually educating, trying to explain that, the F-35 is not a replacement aircraft, that it is something that's completely different. It's a system-wide change, but it's hard to understand that unless you're in the cockpit and you're actually flying it. Mm-hmm. We find that, so we are in a full-time mode to communicate and educate on that. I'd like to move a little bit here. You're also making strides in manned and unmanned teaming. Could you speak about that to us?
Yeah, we recognized this a couple of years ago, and we've been working with Boeing as our key partner in this endeavor. We're developing a system that's called the Loyal Wingman. It's a uncrewed air teaming system. From the concept that we began with Boeing to the first flight of that system was 3 years. So we're pretty proud of that accelerated development. We're about to enter into the second sort of set of flight trials with Boeing later this month. We're pretty excited by it. The concept of teaming, crewed and uncrewed aircraft, bringing artificial intelligence into the mix for autonomous operations, the opportunities that present here are manyfold. Whether that's teaming with an aircraft like the F-35, whether it's sitting around an E-7 to provide some of the survivability and protection that you might need for a large aircraft, we want to explore all of those. And it's the emphasis I make is we work very well with Boeing. We get these beautiful glossies and a picture of the aeroplane that's there, and everyone grabs a hold of that nice, tangible, tactical piece of equipment, and that's the Loyal Wingman. But to me, it's the intellectual property that our people put into it. Getting our smartest air crew to talk to our smartest engineers, as the industry and the military working together to build the algorithms and the machine-to-machine learning and enable that outcome, to team those systems together, to build payloads that you can change in and out of the system, with digital engineering, having a digital twin that we can try and test and know that when we've done it, that thing will fly, accelerate our manufacturing processes so that we can design, change the design, work out what's needed, rapidly manufacture and put things in place in an agile time frame. Multiple opportunities here. So we're very excited about these opportunities. We know that the US is starting to head down similar paths. We're very keen to work together on this. We don't want to do development that's already been done. We don't want to duplicate work. Neither of our nations can afford to waste money, to waste people, and to waste time. And time is probably the most precious resource that we don't have much of. Once you've burnt through it, you can't get it back. So opportunities such as the Loyal Wingman program will allow us to ideally collaborate, agile cooperation and collaboration, to work out and get the best outcome of solutions that might be available. We're doing in parallel with that. We're looking at Triton as a uncrewed vehicle, Sky Guardian, which is the MQ-9 Bravo. So we're learning. We'll learn to operate those, and we'll be able to pull this together now as an expanding opportunity to understand these sort of systems. And I think they're really important for our future.
Well, sir, I wanted to shift just a little bit and get your vantage point on what makes projecting air power a unique undertaking in the Pacific versus other theaters of operation.
Yeah, I kind of touched on that earlier. As I said, Australia, the world's biggest island. Everything we do is expeditionary. Now, if you overlay a map of Australia over the top of the United States, they're fairly similar in size, but our population is largely down the East Coast, the J-curve, as we call it, on that part of Australia, and we're only 30 million people. There's a lot of untamed space out in Australia, but it's across Australia and our bases that we have spread across the northern parts of Australia. That's our gateway to our region. The neighbourhood in which we operate is vast. Just as a simple example, the search and rescue region that Australia is responsible for covers 10% of the Earth's surface. So that gives you a sense of the scale and the tyranny of distance that we face in everyday activities that we perform. And being able to do and support our key partners in the region becomes part of that challenge. So to get soldiers to the battlefield, to get sailors to project force, to have persistence, that becomes quite challenging from an air power perspective. We're really working on how we do that. And that's, we're very clear-eyed on those challenges. And that's certainly where capabilities and opportunities such as agile combat employment come into play. We need to be able to operate rapidly to different airfields. We don't want to dwell there for too long, noting the sort of capabilities that could be arrayed against us. So we have to work through those geographical challenges, and that's part of how we put our operating concepts forward and how we plan to operate.
Well, you also discussed earlier a little bit about the threat environment, and I'd like to roll back to that a bit, Chief. We look at some aggressive movements in the South China Sea. We've got some man-made islands that are militarized and some disregard for international norms like the law of sea provisions. How do you see this behavior impacting other nations in the Pacific? And what does that mean for Australia?
Yeah, I think certainly the militarization of features in the South China Sea is of great concern. And it's very apparent that those sort of actions are destabilizing. They could promote escalation, and they provide an environment that could be ripe for miscalculation. So we have to be very sophisticated in our response to this, but in that sophistication, the nature of what we do and how we think is very simple. It's about international law. It's about the United Nations Conventions of the Laws of the Sea, so UNCLOS, a key part of how we think and operate. And it's important then that we stand up and we speak up when we see those types of things that aren't occurring. And indeed, we intend to take action to make sure that we can operate in accordance with the international law and laws of the sea. The freedom of navigation around South China Sea, we look to demonstrate and support and engage with our regional partners, Southeast Asian nations, to make sure that that we can demonstrate that we're willing to do that, and we're not going to be coerced against those sort of outcomes, to make sure that that all partners in the South China Sea understand that it's there for all, and the importance of free trade and movement, freedom of movement across that whole area are really key trading routes. And Australia, as a maritime trading nation, understands this very clearly, and we want to certainly support other nations in the region to do that. One of the ways that we're doing that is we currently have a deployment on the way. It's called Indo-Pacific Endeavour, where we have LHD, our large ship, amphibious ship, that deploys with some supporting frigates and ships. And we go and visit various nations in the Indo-Pacific. We do this every year. So this year we're focusing on Southeast Asian regions up through the South China Sea. There'll be movements through freedom of navigation, partnering with like-minded nations in the region to try and do what we can within the COVID constraints that we face, of course. And I think some of their movement will be contactless. So it'll be no port visits, replenishments at sea. But certainly that demonstrates a couple of things. That demonstrates our commitment to the region. It demonstrates our ability and willingness to project and deploy capability. And we do that in a joint context. So, it's a maritime task group, but we support it with P8s deploying into the area to provide surveillance and maritime domain awareness, air mobility assets to deliver other capabilities, and the land force embarked and delivered with our air power. So we combine all of those through Indo-Pacific Endeavour to try and demonstrate and support and indicate that we have interest in this region. A maritime trading nation, we rely on the open South China Sea and the routes into Australia for our own prosperity, for our own security, and indeed our government's going to make politically sovereign decisions about how we do that, and we want to demonstrate that and build that trust with our partner nation.
Sir, I want to dig into one of your previous comments. Something that the U.S. Air Force is increasingly concerned about is the topic of air-based defense. And we could see significant attrition on the ground before our aircraft even launch. And obviously, if we can't protect our aircraft and people from attack, it's a huge problem. And you mentioned being the largest island in the world. So Given the increased reach of offensive weapons, I'd imagine you have obviously similar concerns that you mentioned. And what are your thoughts on this challenge and how we overcome it?
Yeah, it's becoming far more front and center in our thinking. And I think, honestly, we have kind of just avoided that issue for a number of years. I'd go back to the Second World War, where we had fighters based in the north of Australia, and it wasn't too long after the attacks on Pearl Harbor that the Japanese, who I add are one of our closest friends now, but they attacked quite a number of attacks on Australia. You can watch that through a great Australian movie called Australia. And I think even a lot of the Australian public didn't realise how many attacks occurred on Australian soil in the north of our country. But back then, we had dispersed parking areas for our fighters and the aircraft we had on airfields. It was all dispersed to make it difficult for an adversary to target our assets. And we've kind of gone back to the normal linear flight lines, and we need to really rethink that. The Integrated Air and Missile Defence Program, there's the the weapon systems and the effectors we'll use to engage potential air and missile threats. There's the command and control systems that we've spoken about. But another part of that will become, what are the other aspects of our resilience on our air bases? The ability to passively defend. We are starting to think about how we might do that, whether it's separation on the ground and disperse our assets and have the ability and the operating concepts to be able to operate in those environments. Obviously, dispersed operations costs a lot in manpower, in thinking. This gets back to our overall people in the Air Force. Our workforce have to be prepared and understand this. And it's through there, our enlisted workforce, very innovative, very keen to pursue new ideas. They're the ones that will solve that for us. They'll find new ways to operate, and we need to build that strategic awareness into their thinking so that they don't just sit there and accept that we're always going to have a straight flight line to operate on. It's going to be really easy. Just drive out of the air-conditioned crew room, go out, turn the spanners, come back in. They're well across these sort of things. It's that sort of an approach that we really have to think about. And once again, that agile employment, we don't want to be fixed to one base. We need to be ready to move, operate from somewhere else while we perhaps repair the base we've been operating at, and then we can come back again. So there's a number of aspects to this, and we're not sitting idly wondering. We're starting to do something about it.
Chief, we're seeing a surge of attention given the formation of the U.S. Space Force here in the United States, attention on national security space. And are you seeing a similar focus in Australia?
You bet. And I would clarify, Australia has been interested in and involved in space for some time. Our first sort of engagement started in 1947, I think it was, with the UK, when there were some launches of space-related activity from some rangers in Australia back then. A bit of a gap on the way there, but certainly the last two decades we've seen space-based Earth observation. Our Geospatial Intelligence Organisation has been operating and working, particularly with the US, on systems in space that enable those capabilities to be used. And satellite communications, our information area, have been doing work in satellite comms for a number of years. But what's become very apparent to us now, we're a bit, I think, slow on the uptake, that we've recognised space as an operational domain, and everything that we do, and this is not just about the military, this is about our way of life. All people in Australia, every day, they take space for granted. So recognising space as an operational domain means that we need to ensure or assure access to space. We need to be able to have the domain awareness to do that, and then we need to build capabilities that allow us to ensure that we can assure space. So that's there's some policy issues we have to work through in terms of how we argue those cases, but we're certainly starting to build our capabilities in that regard. And one of the first steps we've taken to try and accelerate that evolution and change towards the space domain is the establishment of what we're calling the the Australian Defence Space Division. So we're not going down an independent force path the way the US have at the moment. We're a little small to do that. But I wouldn't discount that in the future. But we'll start with a space division, a space command-like structure. It will be a joint or a whole of defence enterprise, how we pull the capabilities together, led by a two-star, using personnel and expertise from Navy and Army and indeed our defence civilians and the intelligence agencies that we have. And it will most importantly allow us to engage very strongly with the civilian components of the space endeavour. Our government is looking at space as a national outcome. It's an enterprise approach across Australia. They've established what we call the Australian Space Agency. It's our, as much as you could have it, equivalent to the NASA establishment. They'll be our space launch authority. They'll set the regulations for how we operate in space. And they're a key part of our engagement as a military capability. So that engagement is how we'll step forward. We're working very closely with our key partners in the space domain. And just recently I was in Colorado Springs for a Space Chiefs conference that was led by General Jay Raymond. So a great opportunity there to meet with Jay and talk space things and with our international partners. And there's much to be done. It's really important. Yeah, it's the ultimate high ground. And as an Air Force, our aviators, that's where we operate and think from. Air and space minded, that's what we need to be able to do. Bringing that concept into our joint force is so vitally important, and bringing our force across, whole force across into how we operate in the space domain is vital.
Well, sir, we spent a lot of time talking about the equipment and technology, and I know ultimately it comes down to people, and you all have, the best within the Royal Australian Air Force. And just wondering, as we talk about leveraging this technology, what do Royal Australian Air Force aviators look like in the future? We see an aggressive rate of change these days, and certain skills are required to succeed. And they're far different than what we saw in decades past, but also there are some attributes that will endure and stay the same. So what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, the biggest thing is to make people more strategically aware. But it's also about giving them opportunity and giving them choice. We always have a challenge with retaining our people because we can't necessarily compete with the market force. But what we can do is provide them with really challenging and interesting work. And that's where I think we have been successful. There's still more work for us to do in ensuring that that's the case. I'm travelling with our Warrant Officer of the Air Force, Warrant Officer Fee Grasby. Fee is the equivalent of the Command Master Sergeant, the senior enlisted leader for our Air Force. She's absolutely brilliant in working across all of our workforce, and it's not just to the enlisted force that she sort of responds. Her words are, she says to all of them, look, come and tell us your ideas. We want you to be curious. We want you to lead on opportunities. We want you to be innovative. I work for you. The Chief of Air Force, we both work for you, all of you. Don't think that you're working for us. We want them to have the opportunities and take opportunities to build their ideas and bring them forward. And giving them more awareness and explaining the why we're doing things becomes equally more important. They're highly intelligent. They come into our Air Force now and far smarter than I ever was. We need to take advantage of that. We need to listen to them. And if we can keep them curious and provide the mechanisms whereby they can bring their ideas forward, then I think we've got a really good opportunity to be successful in our second century. We need to celebrate the skills and attributes that they bring into our modern Air Force. They are our future. That's where we'll be successful if we can really leverage the capabilities that our people possess. And we've got a few opportunities that we do that. We have a leader enrichment program that we're working on to bring junior enlisted forward and give them the exposure and enable their opportunities in that regard. We have a program we call the Jericho program. It's named Jericho by a chief two before me, Air Marshal Jeff Brown, and he wanted to call it Jericho after break the walls down, remove the obstacles. That was the intent. We're going back to that original intent. and it's about removing obstacles for people to innovate. And we give top-down intent, and it's bottom-up innovation, and give people that chance to bring that forward. And we've built labs where they can go and sit and think, critically think, and make use of the skills and the power that they have. And I think that's where our true success will be. And then it's also about us building not just Air Force leaders, but building joint leaders, people that understand the joint warfighting concepts, people that understand what it needs to be and what it means to be in a joint force, and what's air power or air and space power's part in that, and bringing that forward at all levels in our Air Force. That's where we'll gain success.
Well, Chief, you got 100 years behind you, and congrats again, as we said before, on the centenary of your Air Force, and it's been fantastic to talk to you. Let me give you one last opportunity to perhaps think about, when you look at the Royal Australian Air Force in 10 years, what would be your ideal vision? You've talked a lot about it. Maybe summarize that for us.
Yeah, my goodness. So I guess I might start with where we began, the centenary for our Air Force, 100 years. 31st of March was the celebration of that this year. The birthday year goes through until the 31st of March in 2022. COVID's put a few nails in our celebration opportunities, but it hasn't stopped it. The people are quite resilient. They're determined to recognise this great moment of 100 years of our Air Force. And the theme is then, now, always. We've looked at what we did, where what are our roots, where do we come from, the great work of people up through many years of conflict, 350,000 people have served in our Air Force, over 11,000 of them didn't return. So we commemorate and recognise the service and sacrifice of people over that time. We have a look at where we are now and the opportunities that we have to progress forward and the responsibilities that are on us. And then, of course, the always part is looking at that next, the second century. So your question there, in the next 10 years, well, that's pretty much mapped out for us. You know, the systems that we have, some of the major muscle moves we've had in our platform and the systems we operate, they're set. They'll be in place for the next 30 to 40 years. There are some new ones still coming, the Triton, MQ-9 Bravos. What next for some of the upgraded air mobility systems that we'll be looking for, the Loyal Wingman program, our further expansion and opportunities to leverage within space. These are all things that will start to really shape up in the next decade. We've been fortunate that our government, in the strategic update that we spoke about earlier in this session, with that update, they've committed resources for us, and that's a 10-year investment program. That gives us some planning certainty. Now, as long as we can keep and maintain that budget certainty, it allows us to very clearly map out the future. So with the current capabilities we have, we'll continue to develop those. The F-35 still has a lot more to do in terms of our development of that capability, and we're up for that. And then introducing those new systems. But once again, it's how we do that with our partners, the interoperability that we need, how do we get better domain awareness and share information, our ability to collect the data, that's getting better as we progress through the decade, our ability to network and connect to make sure that data is available to all, make sure that the soldier on the ground can get that information out of the F-35, makes us more effective in our warfighting, being able to do that rapidly in an agile sense in the grey zone becomes equally important. And being able to share that information with our partners where it's appropriate. We have to be ready and able to do that. That's a key question that we're working certainly with the US on as well. Some of the stuff will remain highly classified, it has to. But there's ways of passing information and sharing information that makes us all stronger. That's really key for us. And, of course, at the heart of that are the people that do it. They're the ones that will have the ideas. They're the ones that will create the relationships. They're the ones that will be able to explain that information and make sense of it. And it's through those people and the relationships that we build, that's what will set us up for the next 10 years. And indeed, that's what we need to set us up for the next century, our second century. Thanks.
Very good. Air Marshal Mel Hupfeld, we can't thank you enough for being with us today. And your partnership and collaboration are much appreciated. They mean a lot to us, like Slick and me, who have served with your airmen. Mm. And we respect them greatly, as we do you. And look forward to having Mitchell Institute even strengthen this relationship further.
Yeah, thanks very much for the time for both of you. And your dedication and engagement with us over many years is a key part of those relationships that I'm talking about. They start early. We need to foster them, and they'll build. Our next Chief of Air Force will have contacts with your next Chief of Staff of the US Air Force. That's already happening. That's a really strengthened and important part of the relationship. So thanks very much to the Mitchell Institute. We have our Air and Space Power Center at home, and we're aiming to spread our wings there.
Yes.
And form stronger relationships with organisations such as yours and our Air Force. So thanks very much. We look forward to the future.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.